People become aware, individuate, choose your technical language, various stages and time.
But of one thing they become aware, it's not my sister, it's not my brother, Lord, it's not the deacon, Lord, but it's me, it's me, it's me, oh Lord, standing in the need of something, if not prayer. Or sometime you may have heard the story of the British citizen who wanted a riddle to take back, and so he asked the clerk at the desk of the Waldorf Astoria to answer this riddle as they exchanged them. In turn, the clerk came up with one. He says, not my father, it's not my mother, it's not my sister, it's not my brother, yet it is the child of my father and mother. Who is it? The British citizen, and he suffers in this case, could be someone else, said, I don't know, I haven't the slightest idea. Not your pater, your mater, or sister, brother, or child of your pater and mater. Who is it? Why, it's you. It's myself, he said. I am that child of my father, mother, and though I'm not my sister, my brother. Well, he said, by Jove, that's wonderful. That's wonderful, he said. He could hardly wait to tell it. So he told it on board ship on the way back. Not my pater, not my mater, not my sister, not my brother, but still it's the child of my pater and mater, and who is it? And someone who wished he'd go away at that time said to him, why, it's you, you fool, that's who it is. No, he said, no, it isn't. He said, it's the clerk at the desk of the Waldorf Astoria. Well, self-awareness means that you know you're not your father, your mother, or your sister, or your brother, but you are a child of your father and mother, and you're not the clerk at the desk of the Waldorf Astoria, you're you. And for better or for worse, there you are, locked in the position with yourself. Sometimes a cozy arrangement, sometimes a miserable arrangement. Some people dislike it so much, they end it. They would rather be separated from themselves if it seems as though that's feasible. At least they're willing to take a calculated risk. You may be separated from yourself under those circumstances. At least if I stay around, I know I won't be. So I'd rather take chances on that. It's a clinical definition of suicide. So there you are. To be human is to be aware of yourself. But you don't remain just simply aware of yourself. You become aware of the, take your choice, human predicament, human condition, human situation. And of what does that consist? The predicament, the condition, and so forth. What does that consist? Well, that seems to consist of the fact that the more you think about it, the more you become aware that you didn't ask to be born in the first place. And those of you who have not yet come into that stage in life where you have teenagers have not yet been confronted in so many words with that observation. As the father of three teenagers, a couple on their way out, a couple on their way in, I have had it forcibly brought home to me that they felt no responsibility whatsoever for the fact of their being, and that furthermore they had not been consulted, and that if I was dissatisfied with the way in which they were handling that which had been thrust upon them, I had no one to blame but myself. Translated, I didn't ask to be born, which is of course a fact. And what are we to make of it? Well, some people get a whole lifetime out of it. No responsibility then. It was a trick played upon them, and a dirty one at that. So, when you become aware of the human situation, you become aware of the fact that you didn't ask to be born, but here you are, and what is it, and what are you to make of it, and what are you to do with it? As though that weren't enough, you soon discover, as you become aware of yourself, that you have been thrust into a situation where you have parents and sisters and brothers and neighbors and relatives, none of whom you remember asking for. No consultation there either. Here you are, committed to some kind of a relationship, working or otherwise, with people who are called your parents or your sister, your brother. There's simply no way out of it. How did so many people come to be in my world without my permission? And of course, the worst thing of all, the longer you live is, the more you discover that there are so very, very few people in the world who genuinely appreciate you. One you meet in the mirror, your wife if you make a good marriage, your children off and on. The rest of the time, nobody. Nobody. And it's so obvious, as you know. On a day like this, it should be obvious, too. It's so obvious that we, each of us, is so worthy of reverence and veneration. So deserving of it. such wonderful people, and so few with the perception to see it. People are disappointing, terribly disappointing in this respect. No one ever appreciates me so consistently as I appreciate myself. It's a mystery. I've never solved it. They seem to be preoccupied with the thought that I should be appreciating them, which makes for a real problem in human relations. Now, as though this were not enough, in the human situation, we become aware not only of the fact that we didn't ask to be born and that other people are everywhere and none of them really asked for, but we begin to get the idea, which dawns on you gradually, and I must say reluctantly, that we're going to die. In philosophy, we use an old-time syllogism. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. Now, that's a wonderful little piece of logic and has a great deal of meaning as far as Socrates is concerned, but when I take out his name and put mine in, it doesn't feel the same. Still seems to be logical, but now it becomes emotional. All men are mortal. Richard Gay is a man. Richard Gay is mortal. Oh, that cannot be. But every time a birthday approaches or every time something wonderful happens, one of your friends calls up, comes around, says, "Congratulations, marvelous. Oh, it's a wonderful thing. I'm glad to share this joy with you." And he clears his throat and says, "How are you? How's your coverage? You got enough to take care of this? I don't want to sound morbid or anything, you know, but I mean, and I always get the impression that he's of the opinion that insurance men are themselves exempt from mortality. They plan to be around to collect the premiums, while the rest of us are somehow or other just not going to be around. And they show you these pictures again, you know, a lovely family, and there's the handsome-looking man. It does look as handsome as you think you are, and there's this handsome man there, but it's kind of shadowy, undeveloped, so to speak, and there's an X through it. Then it asks underneath, what will they do if you are missing? Which is a ghoulish sort of thing to ask. On the other hand, it happens to be true of life and death. So you didn't ask to be born, you have to get along with people who don't appreciate you, and you have to die. That's a terrible situation. I wonder if a degree will help make it feel better. A baccalaureate degree helps a little. Sometimes we think a master's will help a lot. And a doctorate, oh, that'll take it all away. Not what I've observed. Just think, all the anxieties will be gone because I will have achieved competency, mastery, depth, knowledge, wisdom, sensitivity. These fellows still come around and ask you how you're fixed for coverage. In fact, some of them have taken courses leading to doctors to give them guidance as to how they can sell you on the coverage. So this is the human situation. It's been the human situation for a long time, it seems, but it always feels so personal. Now, what are we to do with it? What are we to do about it? Well, every culture has had its techniques. You can always abuse alcohol. You can just keep busy. You can try to master and dominate the lives of others, especially those closest to you who can't fight back because they're dependent upon you. You can achieve wealth. You can do all sorts of things. In our society, the one thing we've added is just keep busy. Just keep busy. Just keep busy. Then like Scarlett O'Hara, you can say, "I'll think about it tomorrow. Think about it tomorrow." There are all sorts of ways. Some people don't quite make it, and it must be a miserable thing. If you really were to dwell on this all the time, as some people do, the involuntariness of having come into the world, the necessity of getting along with the people who don't appreciate you, and then having to die, it just seems like it would be a terrible thing. But are there any other alternatives? Well, of course, that's why I've come, to try to dramatize an alternative. Now, surely people who've gone to school have discovered by now that there are various alternative ways other than the ones that I have mentioned to size up life. Not say I'm going to size up life. I'm going to figure it out somehow or another. Now, it seems artificial that anyone would ever stop and do this. Well, it would seem ridiculous that anyone would ever stop to do this, except that people do stop to do it. They don't tell us about it all the time. The unfortunate thing about being a minister is you're expected to do it on command. But even after and before the services, you wonder yourself, see, about what about this now? What does this really mean? And so forth. I'm making the flat observation. Everybody does it sometime or another in some way or another. You know, stops and asks, well, now, what is it really? How does it add up? And what's the score? What does it mean? How, let's put it in technical language, how shall I characterize the phenomenon of living? With what shall I characterize life so as to avoid caricaturing it? Well, I'll give you a few samples. Life is a burden, and you pick it up and carry it until you can't carry it anymore. Then every aspect of it is covered. Everything's a burden. And you've met the burden bearers, haven't you? Life is a burden. Well, let's try another one. Life is a pilgrimage. It's a terrible pilgrimage. This earth is not my home. I'm just a stranger here. I'm trying to do the best I can to get through. I'm a pilgrim, and there's no place to rest. Well, you've met the pilgrims. Trouble is, sometimes they want to take you along on their pilgrimage. Then you've met the people for whom it's all a challenge. Life is a challenge. Challenge, challenge. Everything's a challenge. This is the objection my children have to me. That's how we got up here in Alaska in the first place. They have never forgiven me for being challenged when it was perfectly lovely in Ohio at this and every season of the year, as far as they were concerned. There goes Dad with another one of his challenges. Well, there's the challenged person then. Always challenged. Problem with the challenged person is, too, that he also expects you to go along with his challenge. And this sometimes then makes the children of challenged people burden bearers or pilgrims. Life is a challenge. Oh, a contest, a duel. I myself lean somewhat this way toward it, but as I grow older, I get a little bit, you know, more of a jaundiced view of that sort of thing. Particularly when you lose a challenge or two. Then, of course, there's the one for whom life is an opportunity. Everything's an opportunity, including all the people around him. An opportunity to do this to them, an opportunity to get this out of them, an opportunity to use them this way. Everything's an opportunity. Again, I will not exhaust the range because it's impossible. And what I'm going to do is share mine. Now, my present characterization of life, which I trace to the Christian religion, is that life is a gift. Life is a gift. That's why we weren't consulted. What fun is a gift if they bring you in on it and discuss it? For one thing, you probably wouldn't like it, particularly if it were thoroughly explained that now this little gift is a little chicken, you have to take care of it, you don't want to die. Do I have to get up early and do this and do that? You have to keep your bicycle oiled, you have to do this, you have to do that. Well, imagine all the questions you'd have if you'd been consulted about the gift of life, particularly if you'd been given a comprehensive rundown on all the implications of it. Therefore, it's a gift. Now, you remember I said this is only one alternative. This happens to be the one that I take. You can still remain with the challenge, opportunity, burden program if you wish, but gift is the one we're talking about now. Life is a gift. You weren't consulted. You're just given it. Well, now, for some of us, it's such a remarkable gift and becomes increasingly so the longer we live in that vein that we find ourselves unexpectedly overwhelmed with a sense of gratitude. Now, that does create a problem because, as the Bible has said, no man has seen God at any time. So if you get the idea that this life is a gift and it's from a source other than yourself, where is that source? How will you characterize it? Now we're over in theology. How you will deal with that is quite a question. But there is one thing. While you are bustling around looking for this invisible source, you bump into shadowy objects, some of whom don't move fast enough. They're people, other people. And there have been some people among them who have gotten this strange and wonderful idea. Perhaps the way in which you express thanks for the gift of life is in the way in which you relate yourself to other people. Say, that would be a different idea. Maybe you express gratitude for life to the source you cannot see by the way in which you relate yourself to those whom you can see. I won't burden you with various biblical texts that would underline this. Maybe that's the way it is. Well, at least it's worth trying. It seems as though it might even be a hypothesis with a high degree of probability. And maybe through empirical experience we could verify it. Oh, no, it would never work. Well, why don't you try? Be a pragmatist. Try. Play with it for a while. Well, might do it for a weekend. Well, try it. You express your gratitude for the gift of life by the way you relate yourself to others. Well, I see. Oh, what you're saying is same old business. You feed the hungry and you clothe the naked and you visit the sick and you give drink to those who thirst. And I've been doing that. I've been giving the community chest for years. Is that what you're talking about? Well, yes, that's part of it. Well, let's try this one. Perhaps the way you express gratitude for the gift of life is the way in which you relate yourself to others, especially those others who have not yet caught on to the idea that life is a gift. See, maybe if you relate yourself to others for whom life is not conceived of as being a gift, so that they do see it as such, maybe something happens there. At least some people have reported that it does. In fact, I would depart from the dramatic presentation of enough to say, in my judgment, the spring for all Christian ethical activity is to be found right there. That you relate yourself to others so as to make it possible for them to find the same understanding of life that you have found, that it is indeed a highly remarkable gift. Well, haven't you forgotten something? You haven't taken care of death yet. Now, what have you got for that? Well, the more one reads about people who have found life to be as just described, the more you discover that there were those for whom death was no longer a problem. Oh, they weren't anxious for the physical death, but it seems as though they had become so preoccupied with living life gratefully and graciously that they were not threatened by the seeming cessation of life. In other words, the death question is somehow dealt with by getting a better understanding of the life question. Well, let's make it perfectly clear now. As a Protestant minister, I can only speak for myself when I say that I am not in a position to give you any advanced information or inside information about what is our state of being 1 second after our heart stops beating. But that doesn't bother me anymore because, you see, I don't recall having any information about what would happen after the womb. Therefore, I don't need any information about what happens after the tomb. I do know that for 45 years, this has been a great and wonderful experience, which wasn't my idea in the first place. And thus I deduced the possibility that it was somebody else's idea, and surely an idea as good and remarkable as this doesn't end in such a petering out way. What does it mean to be human? It means to be aware of the human situation because we possess that capacity, whether you argue that it's only a difference in degree, the degree is significant. Much more significant to me, I feel, though I may be prejudiced, than to our Siamese cat and our dachshund, or whatever the dog is. To be aware of the human situation is to find that somehow or another, whether you want to or not, you've got to be able to characterize it. There are a wide range of alternative characterizations. As for me and hopefully my house, it's that life is a gift. And that the religious life consists of a life of imaginative gratitude. It consists not only of meeting the obvious needs of those we meet along the way, but relating ourselves to others in such a way as to make it possible for them to see life in this fashion. Rather, to appreciate life in this fashion. And the more one lives this way, the less apprehensive is he about death itself. For gradually he has come to see that the big idea, which is life, was not his idea. But that as time has passed, by and large,
it's been a pretty good idea.
And I'm glad
I didn't miss it.
And I hope you are.
Thank you, Reverend Gay, for your excellent address. I wished to call to your attention some of the announcements on the bottom of your program. Immediately following the baccalaureate service here, the Alumni Association will honor the graduating class at a reception in the foyer, to which you're all invited. Dedication ceremonies for the Married Students Apartment Building, named in honor of Boyd C. Harwood, Regent 1959-1964, will be held in the building entrance at 3:45. It's too far to walk, and if you drive, and we hope you can attend, you turn left at the old power plant here on the hill, and then continue straight ahead to the end of the road, and you'll locate Harwood Hall. Tomorrow morning here at 10 o'clock, we'll have the commencement exercises, and you're all invited to attend those too. I hope you can come. Following the benediction and the choral response, we ask that the audience will be seated for the recessional. And now we'll have the benediction by the Reverend D.H. Hilde.
Shall we stand, please? Our Father, Thou who art our Creator, Thou who hast taught us to call Thee our Heavenly Father, Thou who hast portrayed Thyself to be the giver of all wisdom to the seeker after wisdom, Thou who hast portrayed truth, the embodiment of truth, it is fitting then that we come to Thee and ask Thy benediction upon this graduating class. Grant, O Lord, that as they move out into the channels of life that their feet shall find, they may be conscious of divine direction, the personification of the love of Jesus Christ, that which Thou wouldst have for them. Dismiss us then with Thy blessing. May the grace, mercy, and fellowship of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit rest upon and abide with us all, now and evermore. Amen.